The views expressed in the following program are those of the writers and producers and do not necessarily reflect the views of KORC, its underwriters, or community airwaves.
You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics. I'm Trevor Serre. On Wednesday, September 25th at 5 p.m., the Corrales Forest Stewardship Plan Update Task Force will be meeting at the Madison Avenue Meeting Room, 500 Southwest Madison Avenue. The meeting will also be held virtually. See CorvallisOregon.gov for details on how to join. For KORC News, Music, and Civics, I'm Trevor Serre.
This is Wendy Byrne for KORC News, Music, and Civics with information about what happened in city government this past week. It was a busy week for city-related meetings. City Council met in the Council Chambers on Monday night and at the Madison Avenue Meeting Room on Thursday afternoon. There were five other city-related meetings this week, including meetings of the Justice, Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion Advisory Board, the Planning Commission, and the Civic Campus Community Engagement Task Force. Have you heard about the Corvallis Civic Campus Community Engagement Task Force? It's a long but descriptive name. Perhaps you took their survey or saw one of their presentations. In January of this year, the City Council voted to create the task force and asked it to gather information from community members as well as local organizations, businesses, and city staff. Their charge has been to raise awareness about a civic campus concept and to get feedback. This task force held their first meeting in March, did their outreach over the summer, and will report their findings to the City Council at their October 21st Monday night meeting. But how did we get here? What is a civic campus? Where will it be? Why are we having conversations about replacing or expanding our City Hall that do not include how we will pay for it? Because that is one aspect that the task force is not to discuss, the money. There is a path that led us to this point, but the trail is hard to find. For those of you who have not followed it from the beginning, let me bushwhack for you. Getting to now started back in 2021, when the city embarked on a project to study the status of the 17 different city-owned buildings. Such a study had not been completed in more than 50 years. The resulting report, with the plain title, Facility Needs Assessment, identifies a long and concerning list of deficiencies, including but not limited to poor energy efficiency, lack of space, poor employee workflow, safety concerns, and gender equity and accessibility issues. The full report, including charts, graphs, and other information, is online at corvallisoregon.gov/cm/page/facility-needs-assessment. On June 6th of 2022, the City Council reviewed the report, prioritized the facilities in order, and unanimously approved a resolution to adopt a priority phasing plan to address the problems. In order of priority, the plan includes: Number 1, a new location within Avery Park for the park's maintenance facility. Number 2, creating a civic campus with new administrative building for the city. Number 3, remodeling Fire Station Number 1 after the completion of the Civic Campus project. And Number 4, remodeling and expanding the Law Enforcement Building. The full text of the resolution can be found on the city webpage in several places, most recently in the packet of information for the September 16, 2024 meeting of City Council. You would not be alone if you are wondering how we can afford to do all of these things. So, based on the data gathered in 2021, in 2022, our City Council unanimously approved moving forward with making plans to make improvements to those top four priority buildings on the list. Number 1 is the new parks maintenance facility in Avery Park, and number 2 is the new administrative building for the city. And I'm bringing this to your attention because meetings about both of these projects happened last week. And to be blunt, it's not about if we are going to do these things. It is about how and when we are doing them. In 2023, City Council decided to move into the early stages of design for the top priority facilities, and on October 19th of last year, consultants from FFA Architecture presented initial conceptual designs for the Parks Maintenance Facility and the Civic Campus concept at a City Council work session. And on this past Thursday, the City Council heard a presentation from the same consultants and from the city's Director of Finance about the parks facility and how we will pay for it. Based on the mood in the room at the Thursday City Council meeting, they will move forward with the parks maintenance facility via a vote of the City Council. The facts show we need it, the staff says we can afford it, and the council will vote to pay for it on October 7th. Would you like to know the projected cost? It's $34 million, give or take. City Council has the power to approve the use of what is called a full faith and credit bond to pay for this project. They can start that process on October 7th. Once they vote to approve it, staff will move forward with more detailed designs and secure the funding. As per the staff report given at the Thursday meeting, there will be no new taxes to pay for this and no reduction in city services. To be clear, it is my understanding that the park's maintenance facility is in such dire condition that no one aware of the facts would argue with the need to replace it. The idea of a civic campus and possibly a new city hall has been more controversial. Because of this, in early 2024, the council created that task force, the one that was charged with engaging with the public about the idea of a civic campus. They also had a meeting last week, and they accumulated a significant amount of feedback over the summer. As noted earlier, their report will be presented to council on October 21st. What will they recommend, and what will the council do with their recommendations? A civic campus and new administration building could be quite expensive, with reported estimates starting at $55 million, and we cannot afford it without borrowing money, reducing services, or finding new revenue. It is most likely that the council will decide to borrow money. Some might say we would get a better interest rate if we lumped several projects together, and they might be right about that. But here we are, with the council following the advice of city staff to pull the projects apart and fund them individually. My sincere hope is that the council will address the funding of a civic campus via what is called a general obligation bond, which goes to the public for a vote. But 4 of the 9 current members of the council are not running for another term, and it is hard to know how they might vote on this issue so close to the end of their service. If you feel that deciding to pay for a $55 million or more civic campus should be a decision of the people and not one of the council, now is a good time to write to your city councilor or attend a meeting and give community comments, because they will be making a decision. And when they do, I'll be sure to let you know about it. This is Wendy Byrne for KORC News, Music, and Civics. Thanks for listening.
So this is the interview that I, Phil Farrell, did with the Corvallis Music Collective that took place on August 28th, 2024. I previously ran it as part of the local Sunday Music Showcase with some songs in between, but today I'm going to run it as a standalone piece on KORC Civics and News. Hey, it's Phil Farrell with KORC Community Radio, and I'm here at the Corvallis Music Collective. They just got a new building, so I'm here checking it out, and I'm here with the founder, correct? And you want to introduce yourself?
Hey there, my name is Devin Cash. I am a musician and the founder of the Corvallis Music Collective.
So just tell us a little bit about the Music Collective, the Corvallis Music Collective, if you can.
All right. So we are a nonprofit organization. Our mission is to build and connect music communities in the Corvallis area. So really what we're aiming to do is make sure that everybody who wants to participate in music can, and they're not gated by needs like space or equipment or anything like that.
Okay, great. Now, how long have you guys been around?
Let's see, we started in January of this year. Yeah, we're just getting started.
Okay, January of 2024. And so I'm here at the location. Is this the first building that you've had? Or?
Oh yeah, absolutely. This is our very first location.
Okay, do you want to tell the people where it is?
Yeah, so we are right in between Corvallis and Philomath on Philomath Boulevard, kind of out on the edge of town. I don't have the address.
It's like right before you get, I think it was 6755 Philomath Boulevard. It's like right before you get into Philomath.
It's on Google.
But so we're actually doing this interview in this like... looks like to be a future studio room. They got some sound padding. So what do you got planned for this room?
So in here, we're planning on primarily doing rehearsal space. So we made sure to get all of our sound treatment in and try and isolate from the street a little bit. But yeah.
Okay. And then is there any other, there's a few more rooms. What other kind of plans do you have for this building specific?
Really right now, we are kind of trying to be open to the community and what the community needs. We definitely have plans for potential recording space, studio space, a mixing desk of some kind. And a lot of that equipment that we'd need for that, we have from community members who just kind of have it laying around.
So being that you're less than a year old, I imagine you're still in the building stages. So what are the, I guess you could say, what are the main steps you're taking right now as the group to get out there?
Yeah, so right now we are kind of splitting our attention between community building and building up this particular location. So the step we're at right now here is figuring out liability insurance and making sure that everyone in here can operate safely and legally. And then on the community building side, we've been getting together monthly with a group of like-minded musicians, started running our fundraisers out of the Whiteside, and just generally trying to make sure that we are connecting people independently of the actual assets that we have.
Okay. Now, is there a certain, type of people, like musicians only, or is this for anyone to get involved? Is this volunteer-based? Could you tell us, like, how could people get involved, maybe?
Sure. So we like to say it's for people who are musicians or music appreciators. Definitely not restricted to anyone who plays an instrument or even wants to play an instrument. Basically, the only requirement right now is that you show up and participate. We are working on getting our website up with a kind of a membership system so that you can contribute to the cause and make sure that we have as many community resources available as possible. But again, low barrier to entry. Mm-hmm. Just come on down.
Okay, great. So you guys work with local musicians, correct?
Yes. Yeah.
Like bands of all genres?
Yeah, we haven't locked ourselves into any genre.
Okay. Absolutely.
Are you involved with any kind of dance at all? Or?
Not specifically yet, but okay. We're always open hearing from people.
Okay, great. Do you sponsor local events at all here in town?
We haven't sponsored any events. What we try to do is we host bands. So our fundraisers to this point have been concerts. We'll get you into the Whiteside. We usually have photographers and a recording of the show and that kind of thing. And we try to support that way.
Okay, great. Do you have another fundraiser planned in the near future?
We do, actually. We've got one coming up on September 6th. And then we'll have one scheduled for October as well. But we haven't nailed down the details on that yet.
Okay. And then, let's see. I think of another question. Is there anything else you want to tell the people?
We recently debuted on our website a community calendar. So one of the big things that we have identified as kind of a need in this area is a way to find events to go to without engaging with a social media platform mm-hmm. of some kind. So if you want to go online to corvmc.org and contribute to our community calendar, we've got some posting guidelines, but otherwise we're happy to post anybody's event.
So so you're in a band.
Yeah.
You want to talk a little bit about the band while we're here?
Sure. I'm the guitarist and one of the singers in Church Ladies, which is kind of a neo-blues project I've got with a couple of friends, five friends. We're playing around. We've got a couple of gigs coming up as well.
Okay. Now, how long have you guys been playing for as a group?
Oh, let's see. I think we're coming on 8 years.
Okay. So you guys have been playing as a group together for eight years. Okay.
And, members cycle in and out, but, mm-hmm. but it's the same project.
Okay. So you guys got a pretty, cohesive group by now.
Mm-hmm.
And then have you been playing music for a long time?
I started playing music when I was maybe 10.
Okay. Sweet. So you say you got a show coming up as a...
Yeah. So Church Ladies is playing at the Chromatic Vibes event put on by the Arts Center at Common Fields on September 21st.
Okay. Do you guys have any recordings of your songs?
Yeah, you can find us on streaming platforms, Spotify, and we can, you know, if you want recordings, we can get you those as well.
So shouts out to the Corvallis Music Collective and the founder, Devin, and his group, Church Ladies. It's been Phil Farrell with KORC Civics and News.
You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics. KORC is presenting a segment of Democracy Now! From Friday, September 20th. For more information on national and international news, visit democracynow.org.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Our goal is to ensure the safe return of Israel's northern communities to their homes. As time goes by, Hezbollah will pay an increasing price.
Israel appears to be linking its southern Lebanon frontier to Gaza as it vows to keep up military action against Hezbollah after mass walkie-talkie and pager explosions this week killed at least 37 people and injured thousands. Then 40 days out from the U.S. presidential election, the uncommitted national movement says we can't endorse Harris, but we oppose Trump, and voting third party is a mistake, they say. And as President Trump continues to refuse to admit he lost the last election. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israeli military jets bombarded southern Lebanon Thursday, while Hezbollah struck sites in northern Israel after mass walkie-talkie and pager explosions Tuesday and Wednesday killed at least 37 people in Lebanon and injured thousands more in what's widely believed to be a coordinated attack by Israel. Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah accused Israel of crossing all red lines as he addressed the week's attacks in televised remarks Thursday.
War crimes, or a declaration of war, you can call it anything, and it deserves those words. Undoubtedly, we have been subjected to a major attack in terms of security and humanitarian aspects, unprecedented in the history of resistance in Lebanon. We say to the enemy's government, army, and society that the Lebanese front will not stop before the aggression on Gaza stops.
Despite the widely condemned attacks on Lebanon, Israel's doubling down on its intent to expand its war in Lebanon. This is the Israeli Defense Minister, Yoav Gallant.
Over the past several days, we have held a series of important discussions. This is a new phase of the war. It includes opportunities, but also significant risks. Hezbollah feels it is being persecuted, and the sequence of military and defense actions will continue.
U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin has postponed a trip to Israel early next week amidst the mounting tensions. Associated Press reports Gallant warned Austin ahead of the attacks this week that Israel was launching a military operation in Lebanon, but did not give any more details. Deadly Israeli raids are continuing in the occupied West Bank, including in Jenin and Kabatia, where a video has been circulating showing Israeli soldiers pushing dead bodies off a roof after a raid that killed at least five Palestinians. The desecration of corpses is considered a war crime, but Palestinians say the Israeli military frequently violates the deceased bodies of its victims. During the Kabatia raid, Israeli forces also opened fire on a group of journalists filming the events. This is an eyewitness.
Israeli special forces, fully equipped, raided and surrounded the area. They started shooting grenades and missiles. They struck young men at our place on the rooftop as they were trying to escape the trap.
Israeli attacks on Gaza have also continued, with deaths reported over the past day in Gaza City, Jabalia, Nusayrat, and Beit Hanun. The official death toll in Gaza since October 7th has topped 41,000, with nearly 100,000 wounded, though the true toll is certainly much higher. A UN committee on Thursday accused Israel of engaging in unprecedented violations of the Convention on the Rights of the Child over the past 11 months.
More children have died in this war than men or women. That is massive. And I think when we think about it, and we know that under international humanitarian law that Israel admits it is bound by, killing of civilian targets on this scale is unacceptable in international humanitarian law and international human rights law as well. And children are always civilians.
Here in the U.S., three Democratic lawmakers Thursday introduced a bill that would restore emergency funding to the U.N. Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, after the U.S. suspended its contributions and in January and later passed a bill barring any further funding of UNRWA until March of next year. Resistance to Israel's U.S.-backed war on Gaza continues on college campuses as the new school year gets underway, with more protests and calls to divest from Israel. On Wednesday, Cornell University students shut down a career fair featuring weapons manufacturers supplying Israel's war on Gaza. Meanwhile, a chapter of the activist group Students for Justice in Palestine is suing the University of Maryland and College Park after the school canceled an October 7th Gaza vigil. In campaign news, Donald Trump said Thursday Jewish voters would be to blame if he loses November's election. Trump made the remarks at an event by the Israel-American Council titled Fighting Anti-Semitism in America.
The Jewish people would have a lot to do with a loss if I'm at 40%. If I'm at 4, think of it, that means 60% of voting for Kamala, who in particular is a bad Democrat. The Democrats are bad to Israel, very bad. I mean, Chuck Schumer is a Palestinian.
North Carolina Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson, a Trump-supported, trans-bashing Republican gubernatorial candidate, referred to himself as a black Nazi and expressed support for reinstating slavery. That's according to CNN, which reports Robinson made the remarks over a decade ago on Nude Africa, a pornographic website. CNN also found Robinson called Martin Luther King Jr., quote, worse than a maggot, repeatedly used anti-Semitic and anti-Muslim slurs, and said he enjoyed watching transgender pornography. Robinson has a long history of backing anti-transgender legislation. On Thursday, Robinson denied CNN's report.
Let me reassure you, the things that you will see in that story, those are not the words of Mark Robinson.
While many have called for Robinson to drop out of the race, he has vowed to remain. A former longtime CIA officer has been sentenced to 30 years in federal prison for sexual assault. Over 14 years in the CIA, Brian Jeffrey Raymond drugged, photographed, and assaulted women he met while stationed in various countries. Disgraced Hollywood mogul Harvey Weinstein pleaded not guilty to a new sex crime charge in New York this week. Weinstein, who's been accused of rape and sexual assault by over 80 survivors, is currently awaiting retrial after a 2020 rape conviction was overturned. He was separately convicted in 2022 in a Los Angeles rape case and remains behind bars. Earlier this week, a federal judge in California dismissed a sex trafficking and sexual assault lawsuit against Weinstein and Madison Square Garden chief executive James Dolan. In the United Kingdom, five women have accused the billionaire former owner of the Harrods department store of rape. Others accuse Mohammed Al-Fayed of sexual assault and harassment while they worked at his luxury department store in London. The revelations came as part of the new BBC documentary Al-Fayed, Predator at Harrods. Mohammed Al-Fayed died last year at the age of 94. Meanwhile, France has been gripped by the horrific case of a serial rape survivor, Gisèle Pelicot, as it plays out in open court. 71-year-old Gisèle Pelicot's husband, Dominique Pelicot, confessed on the stand this week that he recruited dozens of men for over a decade to rape his wife after drugging her so she was unconscious. The case has roiled France as throngs of people have come out to show their support for Gisèle Pelicot during the trial.
I would like to tell Gisèle that we hear her words. I am here to speak for the victims, to tell them that we are listening to them, we will fight for them, that the impunity of men is over.
Gisèle Pelicot chose to reveal her name and have a public trial in order to give a voice to other survivors. In climate news, the World Meteorological Organization warns the globe is on track to exceed 3 degrees Celsius by the end of the century, likely bringing about widespread climate catastrophe.
2023 was the warmest year on record by a huge margin. Leading international data sets say that the first 8 months of 2024 are also the warmest on record. There is an 80% chance that the global mean near surface temperature will temporarily exceed 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial levels at least one of the next 5 calendar years.
In more climate news, severe flooding from heavy rains in West and Central Africa has affected 4 million people, with nearly 1 million people left homeless. More than 30 people are dead in northeastern Nigeria after a dam ruptured and caused floodwaters to sweep across the city of Maiduguri. Aid groups say 150,000 children are in displacement camps, with many disconnected from their families and no access to drinking water. A record number of wildfires have been recorded across South America this year, surpassing the prior record set in 2017. Smoke recently blanketed up to 60% of the skies above Brazil, choking major cities like Sao Paulo and Rio de Janeiro. In Budapest, Hungary, the Danube has overflowed its banks after heavy rains pushed the river to its highest level in more than a decade. On Thursday, the European Union committed billions of euros to aid recovery efforts after the worst floods to hit Central Europe in at least 2 decades killed at least 2 dozen people and destroyed homes and infrastructure from Romania to Poland. Meanwhile, Portugal's government has declared a state of calamity as more than 100 wildfires continue to rage. At least 7 people have died in the fires. Back in the United States, in Tennessee, a federal trial is underway for 3 former Memphis police officers charged over the killing of Tyree Nichols, a 29-year-old black father who was beaten to death following a traffic stop in January of 2023. On Thursday, prosecutors showed the jury disturbing body cam video showing officers Tadarius Bean, Demetrius Haley, and Justin Smith milling around and failing to render medical aid to Tyree Nichols, who was slumped on the ground after he was brutally punched, kicked, tased and pepper sprayed by the officers. Nichols died 3 days later. The officers are charged with violating Nichols' civil rights, failure to intervene, and obstruction of justice for conspiring to cover up the killing. They also face murder charges in a Tennessee state court. 2 other officers, Emmett Martin and Desmond Mills Jr., pleaded guilty to federal civil rights charges ahead of the trial. The Justice Department has launched a civil rights probe into the Mississippi Sheriff's Department that was home to the self-described goon squad. The 6 white deputies were convicted for raiding a home and torturing 2 black men. You can see our coverage of this case at democracynow.org. In Kentucky, Letcher County Sheriff Sean Steins was arrested Thursday and charged with first-degree murder for fatally shooting District Judge Kevin Mullins after an argument in the judge's chambers. Authorities say they're still investigating a motive in the sheriff killing the judge. And housing justice advocates celebrated the introduction this week of the Homes Act by Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Senator Tina Smith. The social housing proposal would establish a federally backed development authority charged with financing union-built, energy-efficient homes across the U.S., where rent would be capped at 25% of household income. The units would remain permanently affordable by keeping them out of the hands of corporate landlords, prioritizing cooperative and land trust models instead. The homes would benefit those most affected by the housing crisis, including unhoused people, people of color, low-income families, single mothers, and immigrants. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
That was the Democracy Now! Segment from Friday, September 20th, 2024. For more information on national and international news, visit democracynow.org. You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics.
You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics. I'm Dan Krall. The following is from the Gazette Times, which is online at gazettetimes.com. This article was published on September 20th of 2024. Corvallis sets sights on new townhouse project for homeowners. Corvallis leaders have tentatively said yes to changes in the development code needed for a proposed 43-lot townhouse project in central Corvallis that aims to provide affordable housing for those who want to buy, not rent. The homes are planned for 1495 Northwest 20th Street, a property currently occupied by a vacant church building and an associated parking lot just south of Porter Park. It is otherwise bordered by housing. During the public hearing that took place at the Monday, September 16th City Council meeting, planner Matt Voigt cited a significant need for affordable housing units citywide. Corvallis consistently ranks as the most rent-burdened community in the state. David Dodson, the planning consultant with Willamette Valley Planning, which represents Portland-based owner Greenlight Investments, said the infill project will offer reasonably priced for-sale housing that is close to grocery stores, schools, public transit, and a safe bicycle network. It also avoids developing greenfield sites at the edge of town, he said. Part of the development plan includes a restroom and additional parking at Porter Park, though what the final engineering and design of that will look like is yet to be seen. Dodson said the amendment to the city's comprehensive plan, which would change the zoning from low-density housing to residential medium-high density, will make other options feasible if the current development plan does not work out. His client intends to construct a townhouse project, according to his words, but if market conditions make townhomes infeasible or the other developer backs out, Greenlight would make the site ready, but then partner with a development group to do the actual construction of the dwellings. They could move forward with a different housing project, such as apartments. If Greenlight were to construct apartments, they would be similar to a project just completed in South Corvallis next to Willamette Landing. These are three-story walk-up units designed for families earning at or below 60% of the area median income, or just over $58,000 a year for a family of four, according to Dodson. According to 2022 American Community Survey five-year estimates, 24% of Corvallis families cannot afford a two-bedroom apartment. 37% cannot afford a three-bedroom apartment. During community comments, the president of the Porter Park Neighborhood Association said his organization is in support of the proposed plan, but urged the city to honor restrictions included in the plan that control height transitions and setback measurements, particularly if a more intensive development, such as apartment buildings, were to occur. Brennan Kohlberg, who is running for city council in Ward 6, also spoke, as he lives directly adjacent to the site, in a townhome almost exactly the same size as the ones proposed to be built. He said that he bought the townhome with his wife in late 2020 after scraping together their savings. He said their home has provided them with a great foundation and an opportunity to build community. The area is walkable, he said, and his church and Fred Meyer are close by. But many young families who run in the same circles as Kohlberg tell him they are moving to Albany because of the housing prices in Corvallis, he said. If we don't approve projects like this, and I think this is almost perfect, this is only going to continue, he said. During council discussion, Councillor Jan Napak said she feels it's important that the units in the development be for homeowners as opposed to renters. She said, "I have high hopes that they will become owner-occupied." The reason, which was stated earlier,
is that owner occupancy creates so much more groundswell of family stability and wealth and neighborhood cohesiveness. The motion to tentatively approve the comprehensive plan map amendment passed unanimously. Formal findings from staff will return at a future date for final approval. This comes from an article published in the Corvallis Gazette Times on September 20th by Ella Hutcherson, entitled Corvallis Sets Sights on New Townhouse Project for Homeowners. For KORC News, Music, and Civics, I'm Dan Krall.
KORC recently had a chance to visit Ants on a Log Cafe, located at 401 Southwest Jefferson Avenue, downtown Corvallis. I was curious about their dedication to sourcing food from local farms and producers. Let's hear what they had to say. KORC is sitting down with Sally Starker, who is the co-owner of Ants on a Log Cafe with her sister Wendy, and we're going to talk about running a local cafe that sources food from local food networks and farms all over our region. And Sally, I was just wondering if you could tell me briefly about the history of why you guys started Ants on a Log and how the business is working for you.
Yeah, well, we started the cafe about just over three years ago in conjunction with the Valley Rock Gym, which opened just before us. We started it as a goal of inspiring and educating and nourishing our community. We wanted a place that was welcoming and inviting for all people and all different dietary needs, and just a great space in the community for connection.
It's a quite unique experience being in the cafe. Maybe you've heard people say before, it's like kind of like spectating at a zoo. And with these big glass windows and people climbing on the rock wall at the other side, it's quite a fun eating experience. I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about local food networks and how those fit work into your business model for the restaurant here.
Yeah, one of our goals is to source sustainably, organically, and as locally as possible. And so I have a wagon here at the cafe that I wheel down to the market twice a week. I work closely and have developed amazing relationships with our local farmers. And so we have about 10 of them currently that I work with closely and get most of our produce. And it's so great to minimize waste with that as well. They give us tubs that we're not throwing away packaging of things shipped from miles and miles away, and we're getting the freshest, best for you produce that you can get.
Right. Large supply chains are something behind the scenes that a lot of people at a dining table might not think about. So you're able to source food from our region right here and have a smaller impact on the environment globally, and also connect local workers and local patrons with the actual work that goes in from seed to table.
Correct. Yep. And we've even taken our staff out on several farm tours, as well as they've gone out picking for us. We've been picked many different berries, blackberries, blueberries, raspberries, and then we're also just going and learning about what these farmers are doing and all the hard work and the care and the love that they're putting in, so that we can come back and do the same here and serve just beautiful, amazing food to our customers. I guess the other thing that we really focus on is minimizing waste. And so we have a compost system that we use. We use reusable glass and reusable containers as much as possible. Even our to-gos are the option of either compostable or glass that our customers can bring back to us. And we have a sustainability stamp program. And we also helped found the Benton To-Go reusable containers that about 9 other businesses in Corvallis are using as a container program to bring back and minimize the throwaway one-time use containers.
Well, thanks for mentioning that, because KORC is definitely interested in Corvallis's sustainability initiatives and how businesses work into that and how that fits into the larger county and state's initiatives to have a more sustainable economy and society. D- Did you want to shout out some of the local farms that you guys work with specifically?
Sure.
To source food?
Yeah. Some of the ones that really have made a huge difference for our business. Little Garden Organic Farm, where we get a lot of greens and strawberries. Riverland Farm has amazing grapes and ginger. And Goodfoot Farm with their greens. La Mancha Ranch and Orchard with apples and hazelnuts. Rainshine Farm with beautiful melons and berries and greens, and Featherroot Farm that gets us our chicken and our egg. Our eggs.
And by the way, her sister Wendy just popped in to see if anybody was wanting to, or because someone was trying to buy some eggs, and they're both as busy as any of the employees out on the floor here, taking the time to talk with KORC.
Yeah, thanks. Cameron Ridge Farm supplies us with our chicken and our microgreens, along with Woods Farm. Borage Farm with our blackberries. Kings Valley Gardens with our blueberries. Nourished with Nature with bacon when we've had our BLTs. And all these farmers have been so cooperative, so kind, willing to bend over to bring us food at times. Or, you know, just those connections and the people make it all worth it.
Sounds like there's a big social element to,
so rewarding.
To
yeah.
running this that is just essential for a cafe trying to do what you're trying to do. And it also sounds like you kind of are able to adapt and build your menu seasonally, probably, from what's available just in the area, because you're not getting this, you know, the same product all year round unless you're sourcing it from quite far away at certain times of the year. Is that correct?
That's true. Yeah, we're working on our apple recipes and pumpkin recipes going into fall, and soups as the weather gets cooler. But we're just, yeah, so lucky to have live where we do and have such a variety of beautiful produce all year round, really.
Well, we really appreciate you sitting down with KORC to share what's going on with Ants on a Log Cafe.
Thanks so much.
You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics, a program heard Sundays from 1 to 2 and repeated Mondays from 5 to 6 here on KORC, streaming at KORCFM.com. This is Dan Kroll. I am at the Farmers Market right now between 1st and 2nd Street along Monroe at the Saturday Farmers Market. And I'm chilling at the back of a pickup truck with Paul Toops from Monroe. How's it going, Paul?
Doing pretty good.
Those of you who may not know who Paul Toops is, perhaps you've seen him offering corn out of the back of his pickup truck here at the Saturday Market for a long time, as well as other locations like Monroe and Eugene.
Yeah, I've been doing this 45 years. I was an original member with Corvallis, and then it became to where it wasn't consistent in when it started. So I focused on Eugene for years, but then I came back to Corvallis here about 12 to 15 years ago and been doing it ever since.
And you grow all your own corn that you sell here at the market?
Yep, I grow about 20 different varieties, and yellow, white, and bicolors, all three.
And we were just talking before I started recording. You enjoy your corn raw.
Yep, that's pretty much how I eat it. But if you do cook it, you want to get your water boiling, put it in for 2 minutes, then take it out. You cook it any much longer than that, and you're just kind of boiling the life out of it.
Not to mention the flavor.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I mean, is it just takes a lot out of it, you know. Two to 3 minutes at the most.
Well, kind of like cooking any vegetables, it does boil out the nutrition. I guess I never realized, though, that eating corn completely raw was a thing. I mean, I guess it makes sense.
Yep. I haven't cooked an ear of corn yet this year, and I eat two or three almost every day. I've been eating it raw for years, and it's really good that way, too. And if I can't eat it raw, I won't sell it. That's kind of my gold standard.
Well, definitely over the years, as I have bought corn from you, I always remember it being very good. And that's why when I saw you the other day
It's kind of, you have a telltale look to you. Even though you don't have a sign, I can still see, oh, that's the guy with corn in the back of his pickup truck. And I was happy to get some the other day. Just had some last night. It was totally amazing. And I thought, because we had had a discussion, that you were going to be maybe experiencing your last Saturday market today. But I guess things have changed since we talked last.
Well, a couple of things. I do sell up in Monroe, in Benny's pizza parking lot. And if I get into overproduction, I may come back down. And then 2 years from now, Squirrel's Tavern is going to have his 75th birthday party, and we cook for those, usually around 400 ears broken half, so 800 pieces. And I will have to expand my season for that 2 years from now if that's going to happen, and it sounds like it's going to happen.
How many acres do you grow on?
Well, now I'm down to about 16 rows, 400 feet long, so that's not a lot, but at the height of my game, I was 120 rows, which would be close to 3 acres, and my best day was in Eugene, probably at 65 cents an ear back then, and I did $1,400 just in corn, but I had customers down there for 30 years. I mean, every week.
And how long have you been coming to the Saturday Corvallis Saturday Market?
I was an original member when it was down where the skate park is now, and it kept getting moved around, which was not a big issue, but it was an afternoon market back then, and it was supposed to start at 3, and I'd come at 3:15, and it'd be half over, because people were just coming. Vendors were coming at 1:30, so customers were showing up at 1:30. And it became too far to drive for part of a market. And so I stopped coming for quite a few years. And then when it became a morning market and we had a manager, Rebecca Landis, keeps it pretty up to snuff. And it starts at 9. And a few people are here earlier than that, but it's pretty much a 9 o'clock market to 4 o'clock, or excuse me, to 1 o'clock, and we're usually sold out before that.
I was going to ask. It seems you usually do sell out.
Yeah, there's been a couple slow weeks where we're here till 12:30 or so, but you know, I've got a lot of customers that come every week once they see a quality product. And this market is full of quality product, though. I mean, it's any of you who have not been down to this market on Saturday mornings, or for that matter on Wednesdays, but the Saturday market's a lot fuller with vendors. And got everything down here from vegetables to plants to fish and even meat producers. It's a very extensive market.
It's a place where you can meet the farmer and ask questions about the products itself, the produce, the meat. I should ask you, I've tried growing corn in the past, but due to the intense amount of focus that it takes to actually grow corn between the water and everything, what's your secret? Do you use sprays or anything?
I don't use any sprays. I try to keep the worms out with what are called trichogamma wasps. They're tiny little wasps that lay their egg in the worm egg, and their larva hatches out first and cannibalizes the worm egg. Works really well.
How would one obtain those wasp eggs?
I get them from Nature's Control out of Medford, Oregon. And they ship them to me, and you just put them out, and the eggs are on these little cards. You put them out in the field, and they start hatching out. And I put them out weekly, and it works really well. I do use some 16 fertilizer, but I use a lot of organic fish meal in particular, which is $80 for a 50-pound bag. But the Indians telling the pilgrims to use fish in their corn was, they had it right. And I do a lot of hand cultivating up and down these 400 foot rows, and then tractor cultivate. But with the hand cultivator, I can get a lot closer in between plants. And then I tractor cultivate, and then to keep the weeds down after I can't tractor cultivate anymore, we have a mower that we go through and mow it down so that we can get the wheelbarrows through when we pick it.
And right now, toward the end of September, is this the end of the harvest season for corn?
It is for me. This hot weather all this summer, and particularly late August, early September, ripened my whole second planting all at once. And so even though I had stuff that should have gone from 68 days to 86 days, it kind of all ripened at once because of the heat. And the thing with corn is you need, in theory, you need pretty sandy soil or light soil. The other thing that people make as a mistake when growing corn is watering. I will talk to people and they'll go, well, I watered it good. I watered it half an hour every other day. I water my corn about every week to 10 days for 6 hours. And you got to do that because otherwise the roots end up right at the top and then they get burnt when you get a hot day. You want to get them actually almost wilted a little bit before you water it the first time because it's running its roots down looking for water, and then you got to dump that water and get it way down in there where the roots are to keep them down there.
I definitely feel like I've seen the exposed roots of corn often, yeah. And charred by the sun.
Yeah, no, you got it, and that's how I do it. I got a 5-horsepower pump. I'm 70. I'll be 73 in October. She came out of the plant in June. I was born in 51. She came out of the plant in June of 51, so she is 4 months older than I am. And farmers will tell you, you don't go buy a new pump. You rebuild the old ones because the impeller is real brass, and they're heavy, physically heavy. But, I mean, she can be a little temperamental, but she's never let me down.
We are speaking with Paul Toops. We are here at the Saturday Farmers Market. Perhaps you recognize Paul as the man with the pickup truck full of ears of corn. He's not here every Saturday because, well, corn harvest season isn't all summer. But here at the Saturday Market, we do have a number of vendors who are here every week. And Paul has been here. How long have you been here at the market?
Probably 12 years. I came back. And I left Eugene slightly after that. And the main reason I started coming here and I came on Wednesdays was because the Eugene celebration just destroyed our market on that day down in Eugene. And I had to come up with a way to keep moving corn on that week. And that's what started me back here. And then it just got to where it was too expensive and too disrespectful up in Eugene, and so I permanently moved down here. And at first, it was slow, but people started catching on, oh, this is the guy with the corn, and so, you know.
And it's cool that you honestly don't even have some brand to go with it. It's just you're a recognizable enough guy, and that's just that.
Yeah, both markets wanted me to have signs, and I had signs kind of in the beginning, but it's kind of like, you know, exactly. People recognize. I've had people walk by me and not realize it's me until they hear me talk. And they go, oh, that's the guy. I'm done for this year, but I will start up in Monroe next year at Benny's Pizza in their parking lot. And I think I will be here for 2 or 3 weeks next year. And then the year after, Squirrels is going to have another one of his big parties. We cook for that. And I may have a more full season on that year.
Well, we definitely appreciate your time, and I appreciate your corn.
Well, I appreciate the customer. I mean, it's kind of like Magic Johnson said about basketball. Without the fans out there, there'd be no point to play in this game here. And without the customers, there'd be no point to keep growing and keep coming. So it's a two-way street.
You're listening to KORC News, Music and Civics. I'm Trevor Serre.
On Wednesday, September 25th at 5 p.m., the Corvallis Forest Stewardship Plan Update Task Force will be meeting at the Madison Avenue Meeting Room, 500 Southwest Madison Avenue. The meeting will also be held virtually. See CorvallisOregon.gov for details on how to join. For KORC News, Music, and Civics, I'm Trevor Serra.
Thanks for joining us today on KORC News, Music, and Civics. We're going to go ahead and conclude with some audio from the Corvallis Farmers Market. It's a setup of performance with drums, a steel drum, and signs that say, "Stop the sweeps, legalize existence, stop the war on the poor, new homes, not new jails."
Stop the sweeps and get the grapes.
Thank you for your performance. What's your name?
James Nicholson. Thank you.
Can you tell us what some of the signs behind you say?
End the sweeps. Get rid of the... We need housing. Get the housing development. Getting the people off the streets. Help us. You know, we will help you as much as we can you. That's what the message is for. Is just help us. Help us and we help you too. Just... You help us and we'll help you keep your community clean. That's what we're here for. I do that. I just clean. We clean up the trash. What the heck? That's what we're here for. We work together, not against each other, and that's what happens. We work together. That's the whole thing. It's family. We're all family. Pretty much live anywhere. The city, the street's mine. I didn't really choose it, but I want to be in my own home, but eventually I'll get off. I'm on housing already at $236 a month. I can't beat that. So, thank you. And God bless you all. Rock on. Have a good day, brother. Yeah, that's it.
Wintertime is often a time of stagnant air here in the Willamette Valley. This contributes to increased air pollution and decreased air quality throughout the valley. You can help reduce air pollution by doing one simple thing. Turn off your car or truck motor when waiting in your car for more than 20 seconds. Car and truck idling emits many toxic chemicals like benzene, carbon monoxide, and other pollutants into the air. Idling is a major source of Oregon's excessively high levels of benzene, which is a cancer-causing pollutant linked with childhood leukemia. Not idling your motor also helps tackle climate change. Gas engine idling accounts for over 93 million tons of CO2 and over 10 billion wasted gallons of gasoline a year. Do your part. No one's asking you to be perfect. Just be aware of these things. Don't leave the vehicle idling. This message has been brought to you by KORC.